four, although to those of you sitting out there, it probably feels like case 104. 112144, and that is Nafisi versus the Illinois Department of Human Rights.
Good morning, Judge. Good morning to all of you. And it's never an imposition to sit up and listen to, Your Honors. Court and counsel for the department.
We don't need argument. You just win. No. That's a joke.
Your Honor, counsel, and with all due respect, Judge Holderman, essentially...
I never want to say with all due respect. I'm going to give you all a lesson today. Judges hate that phrase.
Okay. I retract it. In any event, what is being requested of the court here, and what has slowly been taking place over the whole issue, and I noticed most of the arguments here concerning summary judgments, but in the field of employment discrimination, and particularly in the indirect proof field, what's being asked of the judges now is to convert the method of proof for summary judgment into a tautology. The tautology that's being requested is this. In order to establish summary judgment, you must establish, in a discrimination case, you must establish the discrimination. That's the tautology. Well, that's not what summary judgment is supposed to be about. Summary judgment is supposed to be a simple process. It's supposed to take place when there are unrefuted statements of fact. It's supposed to be a process where the only argument is the law. In this case, there are replete with disputes as to facts. But yet, counsel and the judge below wants you to decide that a decision can be made on this case on paper. It's unnecessary to get into the issue of credibility. It's unnecessary to make observations of witnesses, even though one says A happened, the other one says Z happened. And from the beginning...
Could you be more specific?
Sure. More specific was this. First of all, my client says that she was never told things that were stated in the affidavit of the person she spoke to about what her options were. They say she was told this. She said she was not. They're specifically set out. In addition, there's disputes about the relationship between her supervisor. My client is Iranian. She has an accent. From the time that my client came under the supervision of this supervisor told her, I have no idea how you got this position. You should not be in this position because you're unqualified, because you are Iranian. She also told...
In those words.
I'm sorry?
In those words.
I said
those words were spoken.
Those words. My client says those words were spoken. The supervisor says they were not. There are a number of areas where the defendants say that options were made available to my client. My client says she was specifically told those options were not made available to her. That right there, under summary judgment principles, from as far back as we can tell, ends the inquiry for summary judgment. Why does it end it? Because there are disputed facts. What adds to that? Does it end it just because there are disputed facts? No.
Is there any dispute about whether the move complied with the collective bargaining agreement?
Well, there's a dispute between the defendant's different agents because the papers that my client got, for example, listed what options she had, none of which included a Spanish-speaking
right,
position.
Presumably those, well, she didn't speak Spanish, did she?
She did not speak Spanish, but okay. She wasn't offered that option.
Well,
so what?
The point was that the reason they say that she couldn't step, she was a social worker three. The person who got that option was a social worker three, non-Iranian. Okay.
Who could speak Spanish?
Social worker two, who supposedly could speak Spanish.
How is it relevant at all to her that the department needed someone with Spanish language skills to fill a particular position?
Well, the relevance to her is
you're claiming you have direct evidence of discrimination because the department didn't justify its decision to offer a Spanish-speaking position instead of a position for Arabic-speaking employees. Are you suggesting there was a need for Arabic-speaking employees?
Absolutely. Not only was there a need, my client was often used to translate into Arabic languages, two different ones. Counsel in his brief says he doesn't understand why I refer to Arabic as opposed to the two specific languages that she speaks that are Arabic, but they're just Arabic. The point is my client has frequently been used over and over again to translate from Arabic-speaking patients.
Who uses her for that?
The department. Over and over again.
How many times is that?
I think she may have listed in her brief, but I don't recall off the top of my head. But she specified that she had been used a number of times. So to say, oh, we need people for Spanish speakers, and to not address the issue, well, you also need people for Arabic speakers. Why is that something you're going to exclude my client from? And
well,
interestingly,
you're talking about numbers. I don't know the numbers here, but obviously there are a lot more people, I guess, that come across here than people who speak Farsi, for example.
Well, that's,
I don't know the numbers, but
that's the problem, Judge.
But it's specifically designated for Spanish speaking. Now, you don't think that's fair because it doesn't have one for Iranian and Farsi and
that is the problem, Judge. Nobody specified, well, we have 50% of our patients are Spanish speaking and only 5% speak Arab. Nobody ever brought that out. In fact, what takes place is that nobody ever really asked her during this process whether she spoke Spanish because even that option was taken off the table for her.
Did she?
Does she speak Spanish?
No, she does not.
So?
She does not.
You know, I think we should go to another issue.
Sure. The point that I'm making, I was addressing the judge's request as to what were the things here. But in any event, there are no issues of my client's qualifications that are brought out in the summary judgment.
Are you claiming, for instance, that Mark Samaras said anything factually incorrect in the meeting with her in February? The part-time position truly was the only available position to which she could bump, wasn't it?
No, that's incorrect. And, yes, I am saying that he told my client differently. He told my client that she could not apply for any position that were available at Matten. Nor did he tell her at any later date that there was a position available in Elgin. That information was made available to another social worker who was
not available. Do you have evidence of any employee who knew about the position in Elgin at the time of the layoffs and the bumping selection?
It wasn't, even counsel admits, it wasn't available at that time. However, it became available after the bumping process had gone through, and one of the employees, that's Ms. Byrne, was advised of that position and ultimately got it.
Well, wait a minute. Did she ever state that she was aware of the position in Elgin, Sharon Byrne, at the time she opted to waive her bump options?
Did she ever say? Not that I'm aware of, no.
So,
well, one waived and the other one didn't, your client?
Well, it just wasn't there. It wasn't on the table. The position opened up in Elgin after the bumping process.
The only eligible, your client did not waive. She accepted the bumping process.
Yes, she did. But if she had
allowed, the other woman
waived
and therefore it opened up for her because
she still could have applied even though she had applied for the bump. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Okay. Mr. Berlow.
May it please the court, my name is Cliff Berlow. I'm an assistant attorney general for the state of Illinois, and I'm here on behalf of the Illinois Department of Human Services. On every issue in this case, the critical fact is that when budget cuts force the department to close one of its mental health facilities and eliminate more than 850 jobs, the department meticulously observed a process that was highly specific and that was seniority-based for conducting layoffs that was part of a collective bargaining agreement between the department and the public employee union. Given that backdrop, the plaintiff's retaliation and discrimination claims simply are not sustainable.
How did the position at Elgin that was given to Sharon Byrne become available?
It was the product of negotiations, Judge Rovner, between the union and the department. Because of the size of these layoffs, there were ongoing negotiations throughout this process about how best to reallocate resources and job positions to try and minimize the number of jobs that were eliminated. And the position was added as a result of those negotiations on subsequent to the bumping process being completed for all employees, in a way, as a means of expanding the opportunities for the people that had waived their bump option or who did not have a bump option. So against that, it seems to me that there's very little to be gleaned by the availability of the Elgin position that neither of the employees would have been able to bump into in the first instance that becomes available down the road.
So what's your evidence that she knew when she met with Samaras that she could opt out of the bumping process?
Judge Rohner, if you look at the letter that was sent to her on the eve of the bumping process, and I believe the fourth or fifth paragraph, it says, you may waive your right to bump. Now, that obviously comes with a cost. You lose your guaranteed employment with the department if a qualified position is not available when it comes time to pick from the vacant positions. But there is documentary evidence here that contradicts her report that she was never told. Now, there certainly is a conflict, as the plaintiff's counsel identifies, about whether she was reminded of that option when she went in for her bump meeting. But there's simply no evidence to suggest that she was never told. And if she has forgotten the letter, that's simply not an adequate basis to create a jury issue in this case. The plaintiff also in the first part of the argument here called attention on certain purportedly bigoted and comments about the plaintiff's Iranian heritage and suggests that creates a genuine issue of material fact. The problem is that there is no connection between the supervisor, even if those were true, and we obviously dispute that.
We have to assume they happened.
We assume that it happened for purposes of summary judgment. Mm-hmm. Even if that happened, there's no evidence connecting that supervisor to the bumping process or the layoffs in general. Both Mr. Samaras and Ms. Bailey, the supervisor, testified that Ms. Bailey played no part in the administration or execution of these layoffs or the planning for these layoffs. They both testified that they don't know each other and that they've never had a conversation. So absent the only basis that the plaintiff has identified for saying that she was involved is her own speculation. In her own deposition, she testifies, she was asked repeatedly, why do you think Ms. Bailey was involved? What is your basis for believing that Ms. Bailey was involved? And she repeatedly insists, because I know, because I believe it, because she's important. And when finally pressed to provide some sort of tangible documentary statement that gave her some belief that Ms. Bailey might have been involved, she indicated that when the plaintiff informed Ms. Bailey that she was accepting the part-time position, Ms. Bailey responded, well, why did you accept that? And what she's asking the court to do is infer from that, one, that Ms. Bailey was upset about that decision, and second, that Ms. Bailey therefore must have been involved in the planning of these layoffs and that her plan had gone awry. That's the epitome of piling inference upon inference, and the plaintiff is only entitled to reasonable inferences. I don't think that question alone creates a reasonable inference that Ms. Bailey was involved in the layoffs themselves. So, unless there are any other specific questions from the court, I'm happy to rest on my brief.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
How much time? A minute. Okay. Why don't we give Mr. Andre three? Just add two more minutes.
Judge, my client, in her response to this summary judgment proceeding, specified that there were meetings conducted between the supervisor and those who were being bumped repeatedly. She indicated that there was a bumping process in prior years that Ms. Bailey was involved in as well. So it wasn't simply that she speculated that because of the fact that Ms. Bailey was upset that she
What evidence can you identify to support that assertion?
None other than her own observations and her hearing of discussions between Ms. Bailey and other employees that were involved in the process. She was present while she had conversations with people who were involved in the whole bumping process, and she advised Ms. Bailey those persons as to why they should go about it. And the truth of the matter is it comes out from the fact that Ms. Bailey obviously was aware that there were other options that my client had to the bumping process. If she was so uninvolved in the process at all, why would she care? Why would she even know that there were options that she had other than to accept the part-time position? And why would she express some emotional response about it if she didn't know anything about it? These are the types of reasonable inferences that also go in the calculation of whether or not summary judgment is appropriate, whether or not we can have a paper trial rather than a jury trial. The evidence in this case shows that my client was entitled to a jury trial, not a paper trial. And we ask that this summary judgment decision be reversed and she be allowed to have that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case, of course, will be